It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Friday, May 12th, 2023. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Media commentary columnist Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And Christine's colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, Washington commentary columnist Matthew Continetti. Hi, Matt.
Hi, John.
Matt, we're going to talk about Title 42 and the immigration crisis, but Matt does have a piece out this morning reflecting on some of the themes we've been talking about this week, about the invisibility of the Republican primary, by which I think what you mean by that is that there's a front runner and none of the other candidates are talking about the liabilities, problems, or difficulties of the front runner, thus raising the question of what it is that they're doing. And you make the point, you try to sort of deromanticize or bring back into proportion the fact of Trump's actual political power in the United States, which is to say that aside from the astonishing victory in 2016, his record is bad. His record, his own reelection, and the effect that he had on the Republican Party in 2018, 2020, and 2022, which would suggest vulnerability, but we see that there are people running against him who are not doing anything to enhance this message of vulnerability to other Republicans, and therefore he just seems to be waltzing in to domination.
Yeah, I mean... I was just thinking about previous primary cycles where typically you have a front runner and the natural response of the people who want to climb in front of the front runner is to attack him or her. And that's the, you know, I've been, my first presidential campaign was 2004. You know, I'm a youngster, but that was the case in the Democratic primary in 2004. You know, Howard Dean kind of exploded over the summer of 2003. And then they all started trying to, his rivals started scrambling to try to figure out how to attack him. And, Dick Gephardt was caught up in that. And John Kerry eventually got the nomination. John Edwards was involved. And then in 08, the same thing. You know, you had Rudy Giuliani was a very strong frontrunner in 2007. McCain's campaign looked like it had collapsed. Mitt Romney was in the mix. And in the December of 2007, McCain started really talking about the success of the surge in Iraq, kind of hitting Romney on his lukewarm support for the surge. And McCain comes. And of course, with Obama and Hillary, it was the same thing. Hillary was just a formidable front runner in 2008, all through 2007, until basically November, December, and Obama really starts making the case for change in leadership. And my point in the column at the Free Beacon this morning is, no one's making the case for a change. No one, in fact, everyone is defending Trump, which is kind of amazing. You know, you have Nikki Haley, the former South Carolina governor, who is, she's a woman, in case we haven't noticed. And the headlines out of the sexual assault and defamation verdict in New York, she completely avoided the question entirely. She didn't want to talk about it. That's his case, she said. That's not my case. I want to talk about this. Well, what else do you want to talk about? You're in single digits. The only way you get out of single digits is by attacking the front runner. And so that's why I call this the very invisible primary, a play on the typical political science understanding of the invisible primary, which is, you know, what goes on behind the scenes with donors and party chairman and Dubuque and things like that. This is an invisible primary in the sense that it's not happening. And so Trump is just kind of waltzing toward the nomination.
E. Jean Carroll did something interesting yesterday. You know what? I think I'm on the wrong mic. Hold on a second.
Let me get on. I was going to ask because it sounds...
That is very peculiar, but I think that I...
Now you're on your mic.
Now I'm on the right mic. Okay, I apologize. So we're actually doing this very early in the morning, and I'm a little foggy. So E. Jean Carroll did something interesting after the CNN town hall. She said, I'm going to sue him again. I just won a case for defamation. He is now, a jury has found him liable for defaming me. And then he went out and he called me a whack job. I'm going to sue him again. And you know what? She'll win again. I mean, it's an open and shut case. Either, and if Trump wants to contest it, they're just going to have to rerun the case before. So what's he going to do this time? Come to the courtroom and defend himself? Have the Access Hollywood tape played again? This isn't a persecution on his part by her in this case. Jury found him liable for defaming her, and then he said exactly the same thing in front of... and actually, I would say a startlingly small audience, I would say, after 2 weeks of this. Like, 3 million people watched, which is sort of like an ordinary night of Tucker Carlson before Tucker Carlson got fired. Like, it wasn't like 10 billion people watched this thing. So... that was imprudent of him. Now, maybe people love his imprudence and they love the fact that he'll say whatever he wants to say, but we get back to the point that everybody who loves Trump for his Trumpiness is already in his camp. I don't know what the point is of being a Republican running against him if you're not trying to reset the table and say that there are 70% of Republicans who maybe are, even if they say, because they're not going to be nice to the media and they want to say that they like Trump, that they want to turn somewhere else. And that's not going to happen organically.
His imprudence now, and I really think the town hall showed this to great effect, his imprudence now is entirely in his own individual defense. I won the election. I didn't know this whack job. It's all about him. Now, it's always been about him. But what was effective in 2016 was when he talked in an imprudent manner about the things that ordinary Americans who didn't feel they were being represented by either party, and particularly not the old guard Republican Party, heard him say about the border, heard him say about their economic opportunities, heard him say about, you know, their ability to be proud about who they are as Americans and in their own country. So I think, again, that's a shift that those of us who watch this at a granular level have noticed all along. I mean, as soon as he won the presidency, it was really all about Trump. And that's in part why his campaign in 2020 was so ineffective. But if he doesn't make that shift, that is, as Matt says, that's another opening for the people who should be attacking him, which is to say, yeah, he's all bogged down in these problems, but he's not even talking about the stuff that you Americans, you Republican voters care about.
Look,
go ahead, sorry.
I think the challenge here is that they don't know how to attack him. I don't know that it's fear of him the way one fears a bully exactly. I think the problem is that if you're a Republican running against Trump, you actually cannot convince those Republicans who like Trump that he's a bad man or a bad choice, or bad for the party. I don't think that, in the same way that the people who already like him, the people who already hate him for all the obvious reasons hate him,
I think what's required is something much more ambitious, which is to sell an alternative idea, a more appealing sort of conservative idea to Republicans, and that's a much heavier lift.
You know, I agree with you, but then we have this fact that only 32 or 33% of people, and this is, you know, systematically the case since 2016, say that he's honest and trustworthy, or they don't like his character. And that includes Republicans, because 63% of the country isn't Democrats and independents all added up together. So there's an opening there. That's number one. Number two, you say he needs to come up, people need to come up with an alternate idea. I'm not talking now about being Liz Cheney. I'm not talking about being, you know, saying stuff like that right now. What I'm saying is, I don't like the way he talks about women. I don't like the way he talks. I have three daughters. I don't like the way he talks about women. I'm disgusted. You know, I accept the jury's verdict in New York in this sense, which is, I don't think that he's a rapist. Jury said he wasn't a rapist. But you know what? He's a pig. Not a rapist. He's a pig. Very simple. Throughout history, men can abuse women, says Donald Trump. Well, I don't hold to that. I'm a Christian. I believe that we shouldn't da-da-da-da-da, whatever.
Well, that's breaking news, John.
That I'm a Christian, right? Yeah. I am now attempting to channel the 98% of people in America who are not Jewish.
I see. I'm sorry. I was a little bit confused.
I know. No, but I'm just saying, like, the way that he talks about women is deeply disturbing.
So I sent my column pre-publication to a well-connected Republican strategist who's a friend of mine, wanting to get what the strategist thought. And the reply was a shrug emoji, which I think reflects kind of what Abe is saying, which no one knows how to deal with this person. Mm-hmm. And Trump has been the central figure in American politics now for 8 years, 8 years of our lives. And no one has figured it out.
Yeah, but guess what? Not dealing with him means you shouldn't be running against him.
I agree. Yeah, right. That's my thesis.
Point. Yeah.
But this is the Republican confusion. You know, so a lot of Republican candidates and strategists end up agreeing with Abe, which is to say, well, we just don't know. You know what? Nothing works. You know, maybe you attack his personal stuff, and then all of a sudden you're labeled a traitor for echoing liberal talking points. If you end up trying to attack him from the right, you look like Vivek Ramaswamy, and Trump loves it because you probably have no chance of winning a primary. It's this dilemma, and it results in the case that we have this situation now where the primary might not as well be going on. I will say this, though, and I mention it later in the column. Right now, there's one declared candidate who is critical of Trump. That's Asa Hutchinson. He's at 1% in the polls, and I'm being generous. I'm rounding up on the Real Clear Politics average. Then there's another undeclared candidate who's critical of Trump. That's Chris Christie. He wants to get to Asa Hutchinson territory. The undeclared giant right now is DeSantis. He's at number two. And we did see a little clue coming out of the town hall that his super PAC might be readying attacks on Trump for being essentially a distraction and a loser. And then there's this new Jonathan Martin column in Politico today where he went to Tallahassee and spoke to some of the key DeSantis advisors, and they are projecting confidence. And that too suggests that perhaps when DeSantis does officially get into the race in the next month, there will be an actual campaign. Trump may well win that campaign, but we would have a primary as opposed to what we have now, which is an invisible primary, a very invisible primary.
Right. Okay. So what I'm saying here, and I just want to, we don't need to belabor this more, but is things come up in campaigns. Events happen. Campaigns are about a lot, largely 80% of campaigns, when they talk about what they do that is public facing, are how people respond to things that happen as they happen. So two things in Trump's ambit happened this week: the verdict and the town hall. So if they're not going to respond to the verdict in the town hall, what are they going to talk about for a year? If they want to talk about Title 42, which we'll get to in a minute, Trump will talk about Title 42. They don't need, no one needs them to talk about Title 42. No one's saying, I gotta hear what Chris Christie has to say about Title 42. I'm desperate to hear what Ron DeSantis has to say about Title 42. No one's asking. However, what they're interested in, even if it's negatively, is how they feel about the verdict. Everyone's interested in what people think about the verdict who are sort of in and around Trump. Everybody in America, including Trump partisans. They thrill to the fact that Marco Rubio, that tower of jello, says that the jury is liberal. That's great, you know. So they love hearing that, and you know, it's all fine, but it's like, again, there is a bizarre lack of affect in this entire race. You're running against Trump, and you're not running against Trump because you don't know how. Well, then try something.
Okay, but
nothing is not a strat. Nothing is not a run.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because a lot of this is a manufactured narrative of the media, which loves Trump because Trump is like the huge beached whale that all the different creatures can feast on for weeks, you know, while the carcass rots. That's what he is to them. But I mean, look, Ron DeSantis made a pretty bold statement about Title 42 and immigration yesterday or Wednesday. He's like, if you're an illegal immigrant, don't come to Florida. We're going to enforce the law. That's a really strong message. That's actually a message that's going to resonate. It certainly resonates with a lot of Florida voters. But given the absolute hellscape crisis at the border now that Title 42 is expired, that's going to resonate with a lot of people. Now, you did get some media pushback for DeSantis saying, oh, how cruel, how awful. And, you know, mayors like Adams in New York and others saying all these governors like Greg Abbott in Texas, they're just trying to attack black mayors. I mean, they don't really have a response to a strong Republican who stands up and says, you know what, our country needs a secure border. I would enforce that border. If as a governor of a state, if you come across here illegally, we will enforce the law to the extent possible. That's a good message. And Trump always, you know, sort of meanders back into his discussion of what he did when he was president, like boastfulness, rather than what this crisis would look like if he was running the country again in 2 years.
Okay. I don't mean to belittle what DeSantis said about Title 42 or anything like that. It's important what people say about policy. The policy, by the way, is an enormous gift to the other Republicans, because Trump is incoherent on policy. He has large themes, but his specifics are very weird. And I'm not saying that people should go out and, you know, write a 250-page policy papers, because that's not what the Republican Party necessarily wants. But again, you're just looking for targets of opportunity to get into the national conversation and to seem like you're a steward of the American future. Like, that's part of the point here. And if you have no bravery and if you have no willingness to give it a shot, you know, people always make fun of, you know, over the years, politicians go unconventional. Like, Trump is the ultimate unconventional politician, right? Clinton, like, battled through Jennifer Flowers and, you know, the bimbo eruptions and stuff like that in order to save himself. But, you know, over the time, people try things and they don't go well. Liddy Dole ran for president, tried to be a Republican in favor of gun control. So it didn't work. But it wasn't a dumb strategy. Like, she had nothing. She didn't have much else to go on. And so she thought, let me try this let's see if there is an audience for this among the famous suburban Republican women. And it turned out there really wasn't one. Others have tried different things. Dick Gephardt tried, you know, in 88 or 92, you know, tried, you know, being protectionist, essentially. Didn't really work. But again, like, that's one of the ways that we learn what is and what isn't of interest to voters, is when national themes are attempted in the course of presidential campaigns. And why not give it a shot if you're at 1%?
It occurs to me while we're having this conversation that the fracturing of the media landscape and kind of the tribalization of our politics seriously limits what you're describing. And maybe the difference between, say, the 2016 and 2024, which is that now if you make an argument about a rival that in any way resembles liberal criticism of that rival, you are delegitimized in the eyes of Republicans and many conservative media outlets. You were seen as just simply parroting liberal talking points, no matter that, you know what, most of the country may end up agreeing with those liberal talking points. There is this other half of the country that does come into the equation in a general election. And it's the same thing with even the ideological experimentation that you're talking about with, you know, Liddy Dole wants to be the mom, you know, the mom, or Dick Gephardt wants to see what happens with trade in a Democratic primary. Trump, of course, remember all of the heat that he had to withstand in 2016 when he did go out of the box on several issues, entitlements, trade, foreign policy, right? Everyone said, that's not conservative. That's not conservative. And then he won. And now he's redefined conservatism in the minds of these Republicans so that if you deviate from Trump, you have to withstand the same heat, which, oh, that's not conservative. That's not conservative. And none of the rivals that we have seen so far are willing to take that heat. So we have this weird primary fight in the Republican Party where it's like, well, why do we have all these candidates if they're not actually differentiating themselves from Trump on either personality or politics? It's kind of confusing. Maybe it will change, but, you know, it's May of the off year, and it hasn't yet.
But I'm not sure that the dynamic you describe with the partisan media is a two-way street. Meaning, I think Trump is allowed to sort of mimic or borrow perceived liberal criticisms of his conservative or Republican rivals. He can get away with it. You just can't do it to Trump because he is the poster boy for the liberal witch hunt.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree with everything that's being said here. No one is going to break him if they don't try. I mean, maybe Deus Ex Machina is going to come down and, you know, Jack Smith is going to indict him 257 times, and so will Fonnie Willis in Atlanta. And
can I add to that? Yeah. Actually, I'm as skeptical as you that the lawfare against him is going to help. I always believe that one big case won by one person is going to be a story and a hit for a candidate like Trump. But there are just so many cases. And actually, you know, if he gets hit with another defamation suit by E. Jean Carroll, that's just add it to the pile. There's so much that I think it challenges American voters and primary voters who already are sympathetic to him, his victimhood narrative, to just say, well, just look at all this stuff. They're just throwing anything at the wall to see if it'll stick, even if each individual case, in fact, right, has merit.
Right. But, you know, it's not a great thing for him to have to spend months dealing with legal strategy. Like, it's a distraction and it's all this, and maybe it helps him. Maybe it helps him get the nomination. It won't help him. Again, all of this is bad for him in terms of getting elected president in November 2024. the E. Jean Carroll thing is a net terrible negative for him in terms of actually becoming president again. You know, he wants to run for president as though he's running for the leadership of the Republican Party, which is a lock he broke or a code that he broke in 2016. Who can blame him? Like, you know, he won an unprecedented and a startling victory. But once he did that against Hillary Clinton, which is a very important against, you know, he hasn't broken any locks since. And he's still, you know, he's still running that race and hoping that nationally he can, you know, tar Biden enough that people won't, or, you know, Biden's age, whatever. Again, I just, none of this is helpful to him. It's helpful to him with 25% of the electorate, the Republican primary electorate that will make him the nominee is maybe 25% of the overall vote at most when it comes down to how many. I mean, I think 37 million people, I think, voted was it 2016? I think 37 million people voted in the Republican primary, something like that, for president. You know, in 2018, 62 million Democrats voted to put 40 Democrats in the House. Like, the Republican primary electorate is a sliver of what you need to win the presidency. It's the base of your vote. He's going to need another 55, 60 million voters, maybe, particularly if the race doesn't flower. Like, let's say DeSantis fades and Trump's ahead 60-20 or 60-30 or something like that. No one's going to come out and vote in the primaries. The race will be over. Like, no one's, it's going to be no excitement. They're not going to go to they're not going to choose anybody. So, you know, then he won't even get them to the polls in the winter and early spring to at least have them on tap to vote in November, which is, you know, the likeliest way you know that someone's going to vote is if they voted in the primary, they will be there in the general. And that may not happen. Okay, let me take a pause and talk to you about Bambi, our advertiser today, because, you know, those human resource issues can kill you. You know that. Bad employees, troublesome fights between people in your office, how they're going to come back to the office when they've gotten comfortable working at home, if you need them at the office, how to do split time and make sure that everyone's doing what they're doing. With Bambi, you get access to your own dedicated HR manager starting at just $99 per month, available by phone, real-time chat, and email, so onboarding and terminations run smoothly, team members reach peak performance, and your business stays compliant with changing HR regulations. And with Bambi's HR autopilot, you'll automate important HR practices like setting policies, training, and feedback. HR managers can easily cost $80,000 a year, but Bambi starts at $99 per month. Schedule your free conversation today to see how much Bambi can take off your plate. So go to bambee.com right now and type in Commentary Magazine under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. Spelled bambee.com, bambee.com. Type in Commentary Magazine. So at last, the media have to reckon with the fact that there is a border crisis that isn't just kids being put in cages and people being treated so unfairly like we're in Nazi Germany, that there's something else going on here. And the TV footage, you know, is just absolutely, you know, you've never seen anything like it. And in some ways, it's the polar opposite of 2015 and the migrant crisis that afflicted Europe as a result of the Syrian civil war in particular, because, of course, the images that altered European politics forever were images of refugees dying as they attempted to get away from a horrible civil war, right? And the kids, a kid dead on the beach, stuff like that. This is all like the Who concert where people were getting trampled. You know, it's like people running, you know, 10,000 people on a bridge, It is chaos. It is, you know, it is nightmarish images. You then think about the people who have to deal with this mass of human bodies pushing at the border, the American officials who, you know, like are just doing their jobs day by day to, you know, having to deal with this. And it just changes the entire dynamic of the conversation about immigration outside of the world. And for the last 30 years or 25 years in which we, as you know, on the right have been dealing with the increasing level of skepticism and outright hostility toward immigration into the United States. I don't know how an ordinary person sees this stuff that has been really kept from them for the most part and doesn't go, what the hell is going on here? How can the president have let this happen?
Well, that's the key. That's the key. This happened on Biden's watch. They knew it was the Title 42 would expire. They knew they needed to have these measures in place. They knew, and because groups and members of the federal government who do this had been driving these estimates up. You know, remember not long ago, it was supposed to be like, oh, 100,000 people might cross the border, you know, after Title 42. Well, we're well past that. And the number of getaways, you know, people who just aren't, who just are released into the United States with no paperwork, no documentation, that's increased. And then even the ones who are documented, given a date to return and appear in court, that date's set at about, I think, 2027 now. That's so that they will be here, you know, with a paper saying you got to show up back in court in years in order to start this process for asylum seeking. It is a disaster, both for the people who want to come to this country and establish themselves as citizens, who are desperate. And I'm, you know, like you, John, and I think most of us on this podcast, I think immigration is what powers this country. It's a very good thing. The system has been broken for a very long time, but the acceleration of the brokenness has happened under Biden because his caucus, the Democrats, have shifted wildly left when it comes to immigration. There's a very loud and very ardent number of Democrats and then a whole bunch of NGOs and other progressive groups on the left that don't think the border should be restricted at all, should have an open border. And you can tell that the shift has occurred because like the lone centrist Democrat, like Henry Cuellar of Texas, who says, you know, I'm really kind of in the middle on immigration. I'm not to the far left. He has been absolutely isolated in his own caucus. So there's a lack of willingness to think through policy solutions. I know the House, Scalise and others in the House have come up with one proposal this week. But I do think American voters should absolutely judge the competence of the Biden administration and their willingness to vote for another 4 years of this by looking at the images this week, because this problem is not going to be solved. It is a national security risk. It's bringing drugs into the country. It is turning even very pro-immigration conservatives like myself, you know, sort of despairing about our ability as a country to fix this problem.
There is a illustration of the divide politically. Yesterday, the House passed their immigration bill. It was a sweeping border bill. They passed it only losing two Republican votes, but all of the Democrats voted against it, which I think is interesting because the Democrats are still view an enforcement policy on the border as inhumane. Meanwhile, though, in the Senate, the Democrats look rather different. And the Democrats who are in cycle in swing or red states are actually working with Republicans on some sort of bill, which the main thrust of which seems to be to reimpose Title 42, the emergency measure, which has allowed the Border Patrol to expedite the deportations. And so it's a revealing, I think, look at the two parties, but also that the Democrats are divided here because you see this real gap between the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats, especially figures like Sinema, Manchin, Tester, and even Sherrod Brown, who is up for re-election next year, typically a very progressive senator, but understands that this could be the issue which ends his career in the Senate.
Can we talk about another issue that might split Democrats and will not split Republicans at all? And that is the fact that sometime today, Daniel Penney, the 24-year-old Marine who placed the out-of-control subway menacer Jordan Neely in a chokehold on the F train, from which Neely emerged dead, is surrendering in New York on charges of second-degree manslaughter. Abe wrote a very powerful post last week when the news first broke, saying that he would like to, essentially, he would like to shake Daniel Penney's hand for being somebody who actually did something in a moment of menace that most New Yorkers are too afraid to do. And I think we're all supposed to say, yes, it's a really terrible thing. It's a horror. It's tragedy. What happened to Jordan Neely, and he didn't get the help that he needed, and the system failed him, and all of that. But and I know this is very New York specific, so other people elsewhere may not have the same emotions about this that certain people who ride the subways do. But I think this has the potential to be one of those sotto voce crime issues that people that can have real bite politically, and that Democrats outside of the Democrats who get 70% of the vote in urban settings from, you know, from minorities and progressives are going to be kind of scared of. Like, I don't think they want to look like they think it's okay that you throw the book at somebody who stepped in to try to prevent something horrible happening from somebody who was frightening and who had just 2 years earlier punched a woman so hard that he broke her eye socket. A woman in her 60s. I would had normally 42 prior arrests. Go ahead.
I would normally be inclined to agree with you, but I think what happened here is that the activists took such total control of this story so fast and pushed their side of this that it really sort of overtook the whole affair. I mean, when this initially happened, I sort of thought it was going to be treated more like the Harlem Bodega employee who defended himself with a knife from attack, killing his attacker, and then was charged with murder and sent to waited in Rikers Island for 2 weeks before Alvin Bragg changed his mind because the public outcry was in his favor. And something like the opposite happened here, and it's become it's not much of a local issue. It's really sort of overtaken on the national level here. So I'm not sure where this goes.
I don't know. I don't know that it's overtaken it. Go ahead.
I was actually gonna agree with John because I follow local crime discussions on various sites and chat rooms and stuff here in DC, and what has happened is it sparked a really fascinating discussion, even in a deep blue city like mine, about what are subway and bus riders expected to do? We are no longer, even the ones who want to stare at our phone and just hope the guy who's screaming and shouting and threatening leaves at the next stop, or then I get out at the next stop so I don't have to listen to him or feel threatened. Like the era, we're at a tipping point where the era of just sitting there and pretending it's not happening is ending. And I think that's in part because the activists so quickly seize the narrative. The media helped them with that. And there's a whole bunch of people who are not necessarily right wingers. And in my city, they're definitely not right wingers, who think, wait a minute, am I supposed to accept this as the price of living in a city? Am I a fascist if I don't want a guy threatening to punch me while I'm just trying to get to work, or threatening my children who ride the bus every day? I mean, that I do worry. I think that the vigilantism that you saw in the 70s, you know, obviously Bernard Goetz being the most extreme example.
That was the 80s, but yeah.
Or sorry, the 80s. Here in DC, there have been a few instances where people who were being carjacked at gunpoint fought back. One, in an off-duty officer who shot and killed the carjacker in just over in Arlington. And there was celebration on local, like on the local Reddit threads about crime, all the local next door things, people were like, you know what? This is what happens. People have to start fighting back because the cops' hands are tied. If they get there and arrest the guy, we know this person will just be put right back out on the street. There's a, again, it's a sort of sense of despair, and people will take matters into their own hands. So I think there is a lot of people, there are a lot of people who wouldn't publicly say that around the office water cooler because they don't want to be judged fascist or right wing. But that right, the conservative idea that a city should have a semblance of order enforced by well-trained law enforcement, that is not a that's actually something most city dwellers want.
I think Bragg, the DA, may have been thinking he was appeasing the mob that wants Penny's head by charging Penny with second degree manslaughter. Well, in fact, he could just be inflaming the mob. The left wing mob is not satisfied with this charge. They wanted a first degree murder. Instead, it's second-degree manslaughter, and there's going to be a trial, and the jurors may find that Penny acted in such a way that he's not guilty of second-degree manslaughter. That
this, I don't think you should presume that there's going to be a trial.
Right, so there won't even be a trial.
By the way, the case could be dismissed. We don't really know. First of all, Bragg himself could. Bragg, you're right. Bragg also charged the bodega owner with a false thought that he was appeasing the city's conventional opinion, and it went against him very hard. We don't know what Daniel Penny's lawyers are going to say today. We don't know what the case is against him. There is no reason to believe that this guy, who will charge anybody with anything, has a strong case. We don't know what the toxicology report is going to show on what was in Neely's body. As Christine said in our on our text threads, if he was loaded up on ketamine, the idea that he was not a danger to others who needed restraint, and that Daniel Penny did something that according to the reasonable man standard was reasonable at the time, then, you know, that case may be dismissed, or
that's
he may
my
have
point.
To throw it out.
Okay. The second that it's dismissed, or that he's found not guilty of this second degree manslaughter charge, the mob will be back out in the subway, recklessly endangering their lives and the lives of others because they're outraged. I just want to introduce into the record this New York Post report this morning, headlined, "Witness says she went back to thank Daniel Penny after Jordan Neely chokehold death, is praying for him. A strap hanger who was on the subway when ex-Marine Daniel Penny placed Jordan Neely in a fatal chokehold said Thursday she's praying for Penny after it was revealed the 24-year-old would face charges tied to the high-profile case." The subway rider said Neely, who had a history of mental illness, was threatening passengers after he hopped on an F train in Manhattan. He said, this is her talking, quoting him, "I don't care. I'll take a bullet. I'll go to jail because he would kill people on the train," the woman said of Neely. He said, "I would kill an mother effer. I don't care. I'll take a bullet. I'll go to jail." This retiree said Penny did not initially engage with Neely during the wild rant until things got out of hand and he felt the urge to step in. So you have witnesses like that called before a jury if it reaches trial. I think they might be pretty convincing.
Well, and he also threw his jacket off right before that. He basically was preparing to square off and start fighting. That's, you know, you throw your jacket off and get ready to fight if that's what you do. So that was another detail that I hadn't heard until recently. I'll add another thing about the narrative that's coming from these activist progressive types. They're saying this guy was having a mental health crisis. He didn't deserve to die because of mental health. Well, guess what? You guys are the ones who say he shouldn't be involuntarily institutionalized for his mental health crisis. So there is no solution they can offer. They have actually eliminated every solution. The system failed Neely, very much so. He should not have been out on the street. He should have he certainly should have been in prison for assaulting and beating up an old woman. And by the way, let's not forget, attempting to kidnap a 7-year-old was another one of his previous charges. But even if he hadn't committed those crimes, he probably needed some sort of involuntary institutionalization where he could have received some medication and treatment, but the left won't allow that either. So
Christine,
I don't know what people should
do. That's so bourgeois of you.
I know,
Christine.
You're so bougie
to have a problem with this violently mentally ill person running around and threatening people. It's so bougie of you.
It is.
There's something sort of TV Law and Order-ish about the details here, because the video, which is like runs 4 minutes in total or something, I've only seen the sort of small clips, starts with Neely in the chokehold. So we're all a little murky on what happened right before. There's the sort of threats, the throwing down the jacket, and then suddenly there's a video where they're already entangled. So there's that question. I'm very curious to hear the details that fill in that blank in the middle. On the question of, on the matter of it possibly being thrown out, dismissed, I hope very much it is dismissed on the grounds that he cannot get a fair trial because U.S. representatives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez declared him a murderer immediately.
It's fascinating. We have there's so much else we could be talking about today. What's going on between Israel, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas? But we need to move on for time reasons and get to commentary recommends. Last one of the week. Again, recapping the week so far, we had Matt Continetti on Monday talking about the NBA playoffs. We had Abe on Tuesday talking about Chimp Empire. We had Christine talking on Wednesday about The Memory Police, by a novel, a Japanese novel by Ogawa. And I talked about the many iterations of Oliver and Oliver Twist yesterday. Matt Continetti, back to you. Leading us into the weekend, what do you recommend?
Thank you, John. Well, as promised, I'm going to deliver my highbrow recommendation as opposed to my lowbrow recommendation from earlier this week. My highbrow recommendation is my friend Walter Russell Mead has been writing a series of essays for tabletmag.com, that is Tablet, the very interesting online publication, on what he calls the American crisis. And it's a fascinating series so far. He's written about the institutional problems facing in America. He's written a very good essay called Our Singular Century about kind of the frameworks that Walter Russell Mead uses to analyze current events. And most recently, he wrote a third piece on technological change, the work from home revolution, the artificial intelligence revolution, and how the pace of changes in our economy and our work life are accelerating, and what that might mean for the American future. So it's not a book, though I have a sense that eventually these essays will be gathered into or adapted into a book. But why wait? Why not just start reading the essays as they come out? Speaking of Dickens, Dickens serialized his novels. People yes. would wait. They would wait at the harbor in New York for the latest pages from London. I am in that position. I now wait at my laptop patiently for the next essay to appear on Tablet from the historian and foreign affairs columnist Walter Russell Mead. So that's my recommendation headed into the weekend.
Superb recommendation. Let me just take this moment to mark the passing of the father of one of Tablet's staffers, Jacob Siegel. Fred Siegel, commentary contributor for many decades, died this week at the age of 78. He was one of the most interesting heterodox thinkers in America, somebody who would have had very interesting things to say about Daniel Penny and Jordan Neely, author of a book called The Future That Doesn't Work, about New York City in the 80s and 90s. A polymath, could write about political philosophy, could write about unionization, could write about Brooklyn, and just a delightful person that Abe and I think really, really loved working with. And he was not in good health pretty much for the last decade, and so it was always a thrill out of nowhere to get an email from Fred Fine at AOL.com saying he wanted to write something. or getting a phone call out of nowhere saying he wanted to write something. There was a book he wanted to write about. A lovely man, a fascinating thinker, and he will be greatly missed. So with that, we will bid you a wonderful weekend and see you on Monday. So for Abe, Christine, and Matt, I'm John Bob Horitz. Keep the candle burning.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.